listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Anna Quinlan, whose latest novel is Miller's Valley, published by Random House. Anna Quinlan is a novelist and journalist whose work has appeared on fiction, nonfiction, and self-help bestseller lists. She's the author of 8 novels: Object Lessons, One True Thing, Black and Blue, Blessings, Rise and Shine, Every Last One, Still Life with Breadcrumbs, and now Miller's Valley. Her memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, published in 2012, was a number one New York Times bestseller. Her book, A Short Guide to a Happy Life, has sold more than 1 million copies, 4 of which I bought from my best friends from high school and sent them. While a columnist at the New York Times, she won the Pulitzer Prize and published 2 collections, Living Out Loud and Thinking Out Loud. Her Newsweek columns were collected in Loud and Clear. Here's a little information about her new novel, Miller's Valley, which is about a woman coming of age as she unearths surprising secrets about her family and unexpected truths about herself. This is from the publisher's information. No one ever leaves the town where they grew up. Not really, even if they go, says Mimi Miller as she tells the story of her life from the 1960s to the present in a small American town on the verge of change. The Miller family has lived and farmed in Miller's Valley for generations, but Mimi sees change looming at the corners of her community and within the walls of her home. As she grows up and discovers sex, love, and ambition, what has seemed bound together begins to drift apart. Mimi's mother from her reclusive sister, Ruth, her damaged brother, Tommy, from his family and son, and the community itself menaced by the lingering presence of government officials. As Mimi looks back on the past, she comes to understand that her family and her town itself may always have been destined to disappear. Anna Quinlan's stunning new novel is a masterly study of family memory, loss, and ultimately discovery and finding home. Miller's Valley reminds us that the place where you grew up can disappear, and the people in it too, but all will live on in your heart forever. When I spoke with Anna Quinlan, I asked her if her books tend to begin with character or plot or situation, or if there's simply not a pattern to how they begin. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
They all begin with character.
They do.
From the very beginning, I've been a very character-driven novelist, and actually to a fault when I first started, in that the first draft of my first novel, Object Lessons, appeared to eschew plot completely and be little more than a series of character studies, which was remedied between the first and second draft.
Okay.
But I'm just not really interested. There are broad themes that interest me. There are settings that interest me.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, people are what interest me, and I think they're what drives a great novel. I mean, when I look back over the books that have had a real effect on my life, it's usually because one or all of the characters in the novel seemed so completely real that I felt as though not only did I know them then, but I'll know them forever.
Yeah. So in the case of Miller's Valley, was Mimi the first character that came to you?
My protagonist is almost always the first character that comes to me. And actually, it's a little bit like building a house. I mean, you know, once you have the bedrock, you know what size the walls have to be.
Right.
And once you have walls of that size, you know what kind of beams you have to put in. So once I started thinking about Mimi and for example, being pretty confident about her birth order, which is something that's very important to me in building character, and knowing a good deal about where she lived and how she lived, and getting her voice down pat, it gave me a pretty good window into the other people that would surround her in her life. And then having a window into the people around her gave me a sense of plot, because of course plot is what happens when you put a whole mess of different people in a room and they start doing things.
Right. So the idea of this valley and the water situation and the dam and the government involvement, that all built out of your putting these characters in a room together, do you think? Is that?
It was slightly contemporaneous. I mean, it's something, the idea of the systematic, ritualistic, accepted destruction of the United States is something that I think about a lot, mm-hmm. and that I've seen in many guises. Whether we're talking about development or flight to the suburbs or the income inequality that's left the middle class marooned and shrinking in the middle of the 1% and the very poor. All of those are things that I've thought about a lot. And it just seemed to me that water is a metaphor. Hello.
Yeah.
Read the Bible. it just seemed to me that this idea of a place, a home place, which is very, very important to me, being disappeared by water was in some sense a metaphor for so much else in American life that I wanted to write about.
Right. Okay. And it also ended up involving deforestation as well as a theme, which I thought was really interesting at that one scene where they've taken down all the trees that used to be in
the place. The clear cutting.
Yeah.
As you could probably tell by reading, I was going to say between the lines, but it might be on the lines of Miller's Valley. I'm not a big fan of hyperdevelopment.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I always find so sad in American towns is driving through a downtown that's dotted with great old Victorian houses that have become quite shabby and down at heels, and then having to drive 15 or 20 minutes out of town to where people actually live, mm-hmm. in new cul-de-sacs.
Right.
I just don't get it. Given my druthers, I'll always pick the Victorian on Main Street. And and that's something that I found myself exploring both in my nonfiction and my fiction work over and over again.
Yeah. Now, forgive me if I've missed something, but I was able to sort of figure out how far Miller's Valley was from certain cities, but to me it didn't seem like you placed it on a map. Is that correct? Were you kind of...
If I could have gotten away with it, it wouldn't even have a state name in it.
Okay.
So I've been on book tour for the last month.
Right.
And I have been assured that Miller's Valley is in two different places in California, mm-hmm. in Nebraska, in two different places in Pennsylvania, and in upstate New York. In other words, over and over again, people have come up to me and introduced themselves and told me what town they were from with a twinkle in their eye, because they're convinced that I wrote a thinly veiled version of their town, which
wow.
became a drowned town.
Wow.
I love that idea. I love the idea that it seems so real that you actually think it's where you grew up.
Yeah.
But the truth is, it's completely invented.
Okay.
I wouldn't have even placed it in any kind of discernible geography if there weren't for two things. One is that Mimi spends some time in a state office building looking at documents about state water patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point, it became vainglorious not to say in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that Mimi needs to be able to get on a bus and go to New York in a one-day turnaround at a pivotal point in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that argued for it to be in a rural Pennsylvania area, which happens to be an area, a place that I know relatively well because we have a country house in rural Pennsylvania.
Okay, all right. Well, part of what you had to do for the reader, which I thought you did very, very well, because it could have been super dry, but I found it really interesting, was you had to quickly, in the beginning, fill in the town's background, the water situation, the politics, the zoning. And I just thought you did that so well, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about coming at that, knowing that you were trying to engage people by character and by, you know, everything else?
Well, I first of all, thank you.
Okay.
But second of all, to some extent, I think that that's peripheral. That's pretty clearly spelled out in the opening chapter.
Right.
But what the opening chapter is really about is Mimi's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really about the fact that when this huge change is going to come to this place, everybody is waiting for the person who is the person in town to step up on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most small towns do have a person like that. They don't have any elected office. They're not rich. All indications are that they're not powerful, but in fact they are powerful just by virtue of a sense that they know how to do things. They're capable. And she's that person. And so really the first chapter does spell out so much of what's going on here, but mainly it's about the fact that Miriam Miller hasn't said anything about this plan up until this point, and at the end of the first chapter, she says something to her daughter, which her daughter finds shocking and amazing.
Astounding, right.
Yeah.
And I found it shocking and amazing, too. I loved how you established the setting, and as I was reading it, I was really trying to notice, what are you doing that brings me into the setting so fully? And I find that it's the sensory detail that you put in. And in this case, the sump pump, you know, you describe this sump pump that makes a throaty chug-a-chug noise, sort of like a train without the whistle. So there's that sound, and then there's this light from the house behind them that is Aunt Ruth's house, which is part of their property. I just thought you did a beautiful job with that. And then later in the book, the sump pump comes back to have another sort of like subtle meaning or importance.
Right.
So I just thought, can you just talk a little bit about including sensory detail when you're writing? And does that tend to come in your first draft, or do you find that later on you're filling in sensory detail a lot of the time?
Detail work is pretty much my bread and butter. It's really second nature to me. It was actually second nature to me as a reporter, too.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I think I mainly get it from Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
Dickens is my favorite writer, has been since I was very young, and he's the master of that. He's the master of that accumulation of small telling detail that makes you feel utterly there.
Yes.
And I found that very valuable when I became a reporter and was doing feature pieces, because you have so little space. You know, on a good day you have 800 words for a story. Mm-hmm. That if you can find three or four details that are highly evocative to the reader, even in 800 words, you're there.
Yes.
And I've never lost the sense that is... That's really the linchpin of making the reader live in the book.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned the light, because I'm pretty sure that's in every novel I've written.
Oh, really?
It's an image so resonant to me. I know it's in every last one, because there's a scene where she's sitting outside of her own house and she's struck by the light coming through the window.
Mm.
And I'm pretty sure it's in Still Life with Breadcrumbs, too. I mean, the sense of being outside in the dark and seeing the light shining out at you from a window that bespeaks home and family is very powerful for me. And if I had to bet, I would bet that, you know, somebody somewhere can find it in every one of the books.
Well, I might just go look. Your narrator, Mimi, is, for a large part of the book, she's a teenager, a young teenager, and then she grows during the book. She gets older during the book. So,
right.
You know, I had a question as I was reading this, and that was, this is not a YA book. It never felt like a YA book. And I just wondered if you have ideas about what, other than marketing, makes a book YA or not YA, you know, despite whatever the narrative point of view might be.
Well, I remember Madeline Longlo once saying in an interview that she was very dismissive of those sort of categories.
Yeah.
That she thought that she wrote books for readers, and if the readers were 12 or the readers were 32, it made no difference to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I do think we tend to typecast YA and I actually have one child who is a YA novelist. I think we do tend to typecast them as being about people of a certain age and about the issues that affect people of a certain age. But of course, then you turn to something like A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, and it's not a YA novel, or even Catcher in the Rye, which I think grows quite wearisome when you're older, but that still can stand on its own as an adult novel. Conversely, I've always thought at some level that Portnoy's Complaint is a great YA novel for boys.
Oh, wow.
Because if you're a smart boy and you think that you're the only person in the world who is being led around by your testosterone overload, you read Portnoy's Complaint and think, I'm perfectly normal. So I like the idea of books appealing to people of all ages. Someone asked me at an event several weeks ago, it was actually a lovely thought. This woman told me that she and her 12-year-old granddaughter read books together.
Mm-hmm.
And did I think this would be an appropriate book for her granddaughter? And I said, how sophisticated a girl is she? Because I was thinking specifically of the sexual content.
Right.
And she said, well, you know, she's about as sophisticated as a well-educated 12-year-old is in America now. I said, read it together. I want to know what she says. So I wouldn't necessarily typecast.
Okay. Great. Some of your flooding descriptions, you know, in there are storms in this book that affect the valley with flooding, and some of the descriptions made me think of Katrina, which is maybe just where our minds go now when we read about flooding. But I wondered if there were certain historical floods that were most helpful to you as you did your research, and also I wondered if you've experienced bad flooding in your lifetime, dangerous flooding.
I actually didn't do any research for this book.
Okay.
But there are certain parts of New Jersey, not far from where I worked as a copy girl or where my husband grew up, that have flooding on a regular basis. Whenever there's heavy rains, whenever the river starts to rise, Bound Brook winds up under 6 feet of water. And there's the requisite footage of people standing in their kitchen with a chair floating by, and then there's the requisite photographs of people cleaning up afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think I was thinking about is people who can't or won't move, and so learn to work with or against the water. Learn to put in the sump pump. Learn not to keep family keepsakes in the basement. I find those things very powerful. People who live in a place where the natural world insists on having its say, but where they also insist on staying put.
Right, right. Okay, great. It reminded, well, I haven't seen it in a while, but there was a show called Tremé. Have you seen the show Tremé? It's about
I have actually not watched Tremé.
It's about post-Katrina New Orleans.
David Simon, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So the opening scenes when they are showing the credits are just of, you know, it's of that area after Katrina, and there are just these scenes where people are standing in their living rooms and there's just like mildew and mold and everything and all the just drudge all over the walls, and I think cleaning up water is probably one of the hardest things to do.
Or actually, conversely, watching water come in is one of the most helpless feelings you can get.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when there's a fire, there are things that you can do to put fires out. But when water is just rushing into your basement and you stand at the top of the stairs wondering how high it's going to get, boy, there's no feeling of helplessness like that feeling.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about the number three. I started to notice, not that it jumped out at me, I really just noticed one sentence and then I started looking for it. But you had at one point, you're describing a character named Stephen who becomes Mimi's lover and he's her first love. And you say, Stephen was so damn charming. He wore charm like a three-piece suit. He knew his way around a girl. And I thought, well, look at those three statements of who he is. And then as I went along, I started watching for threes. And I wondered,
yeah,
I've got a bunch that I could read to you, but that might not be that interesting. But I'm just curious, do you think of three as a magic number when you're writing?
Probably. I mean, I would say that so much of what we do when we write is unconscious mm-hmm. and inherent, that every once in a while I'm surprised by my own tics, if you will, or okay. habits.
Okay.
But I'm not surprised to hear you mention that one, because when I tend to describe things, sometimes I'll use three adjectives at the very end. I mean, maybe it's a Father, Son, Holy Ghost thing.
Maybe.
who would be surprised with my background? But I think it's kind of an inherent part of my voice as well, that's been there for a long, long time.
Yeah, okay. I want to talk to you a little bit about the character Aunt Ruth. Mimi has an Aunt Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
She's a recluse. She lives in that house that I mentioned before with the light in the window.
That's such a great word, isn't it? A recluse. We
yeah.
never use that anymore. I mean, we pathologize everything. It used to be much better when I mean, Boo Radley is a recluse.
He's a recluse.
I don't care what a psychiatrist says about his problem. Recluse is the right word.
But, you know, Aunt Ruth is not going to come out even to put the soap in the tree. So
nope.
And actually, recluse is a word from this time period. I mean, you've got, you know, Mary Tyler Moore and Merv Griffin. This is earlier than the pathologizing. Anyway, so she's at war with Mimi's mother, who only speaks to her through other people or through shouting through open windows. And she was just a fascinating character right through the whole book. I wondered if you can talk about developing her character. And also just, I found her to be an interesting foil next to Mimi, whose attitude toward Ruth as she grows older is just a very interesting thing to watch. So
yeah, because it changes so
it
much.
Does.
I mean, I think little kids have a kind of tolerance of difference that we lose as we grow up and one hopes regain. But I do think when you're 7 or 8, someone who makes you cinnamon toast
mm-hmm.
Can cover a multitude of deficits with that. Whereas when you're 15 or 16 and beginning to think the things need to be done
right.
and help needs to be provided, someone who will never do it, who essentially stays a child in some ways, can really try your patience, particularly if you're somebody like Mimi who is this no-nonsense and ready to do what needs to be done as she is.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, I'm really interested in birth order, and I'm also very interested in sibling relationships. And I've always been keenly aware of the fact that once the eldest is born, and I am an eldest child, the subsequent children take whatever job isn't being held.
Uh-huh.
And the job that's usually being held by the eldest is the straightforward, responsible, achievement-oriented person, hence
right.
Eddie, who
yeah.
is Mimi's older brother. I think that I thought about what it would be like to be Miriam Miller's younger sister,
uh-huh.
what it would be like to have an older sister who was really competent and really plain-spoken and
mm-hmm.
nothing of fancy about her. And I also thought about what it would be like to be Miriam Miller's younger sister and have something bad happen to you in your life and how you would respond to that. And brick by brick, I sort of built Ruth by thinking about her in opposition to her older sister.
Yeah, she was just such an interesting character, and her situation was so unique, the way that she couldn't leave the threshold. She couldn't step over the threshold. It was just, even, you know, there were so many opportunities where she clearly was thinking about it or drawn to it. She just couldn't do it. And
well, but clearly these people actually exist, because we hear so much about the malady that affects them, as
right.
as Mimi says to her mother at one point when she's I can't remember whether it's when she's in college or past college, she says, you know, there's a name for what Aunt Ruth says, and Mimi never actually says the name
right.
because her mother basically says to her, if you're going to go, you know, trying to spread your knowledge around here, sister. You just better think again.
Yeah, that was funny. I liked her mother. She was plain spoken, and she sometimes was a little bit hard on Ruth, but that was a difficult situation. I really liked Mimi's mother and her just, you know, practicality, and just, we got to get done with what we have to get done with, and her life was hard, right? So,
but you know, I think when you look at sister or sibling relationships, and you look at how the people involved in them deal with one another, the analogy that immediately comes to mind is the iceberg analogy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're seeing the part of the iceberg that's poking up above the water, mm-hmm. but you got to assume that about 90% of it is below, that 90% of it happened long before we came on the scene. Yeah. You know, and one of the things about this novel is it's a first-person novel written from Mimi's perspective. Yes. And what that means is that we only know as much as Mimi knows. So while she tells us a lot about how Ruth and Miriam interact with one another and about all the stories she's heard from people, she can't really know what the past has been like for those two women.
Mm-hmm. One thing that really struck me about Miller's Valley was Vietnam. I haven't read a lot about Vietnam in a while, and I was so brought back in time to what Vietnam was like for Americans at that time. I was wondering, do you mind very much if I read a little paragraph from the book?
Not at all.
Okay. Her brother is Tommy, and he enlists. But when he gets back, this is after he's back, every once in a while Tommy would get drunk and say something like, "The bugs, man, you can't even believe the size of the bugs. They'll eat you for breakfast." But you couldn't ask him a direct question about Vietnam. On the news, they showed some boys who had burnt their draft cards, and Tom said, "I wasn't even drafted. I signed up of my own free will." Then he laughed and laughed, and then he started to cry, and he fell asleep on the couch before dinner and had disappeared by morning. Sometimes at the diner, one of the old guys would say, "They make it look pretty bad out there, son." And Tom would say one of two things, either, "You have no idea," or, "You don't want to know." Then someone would say that we had to beat the communists, or they would take over everything, and Tommy would stand up and leave. He always got comped because Mr. Venti had told the waitresses we had to honor his service to our country, even though I wasn't sure Tom felt that way himself. And I thought that was such an amazing paragraph. It said so much about Vietnam, also, I think, more recent conflicts, but you know, Vietnam was different, and I really thought you captured that so well.
It sure was.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that this novel is about is people in the middle of a seismic societal earthquake. Mimi is in the middle of the earthquake that changed the lives of women in this country for the better. Mm-hmm. She starts out with one view of what her future might be as mm-hmm. a little girl, and she winds up with a future she never could have imagined as a younger woman. Right. And what happens with the Valley also is in the middle of a seismic earthquake between a time when Americans really believed that their government was good and always acted in their best interest, mm-hmm. and a time when they figured out that that wasn't even dimly so.
Right.
And Vietnam is the war that is the big fault line in that seismic earthquake between World War II, where guys came home and, first of all, were confident that they'd fought a good fight, and second of all, felt that they never needed to talk about it again as long as they lived, and our modern wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where there's still a lot of confusion about why we were there and what the end game was, and there's the feeling that unless we talk about it, we're all sunk, and so are the men and women who served there. Mm-hmm. Vietnam is smack dab in the middle in terms of bad mission, bad aftermath, people who badly needed to discuss what had happened to them and didn't get the opportunity. It's a whole generation of lost men at some level for
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one thing that's interesting about that paragraph that I just read from your book is when Mr. Venti says we have to honor his service to our country. And I feel like in the present conflicts, you know, in recent conflicts, Iraq and Afghanistan, there's a big sense of that. We have to honor and thank you for your service. And I love that Tom feels he's not even sure what he feels about that. And I think that that's also true for the people today. They just, they don't know how they feel about that, you know.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true of a lot of the Vietnam veterans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. At one point in the novel, Mimi makes a very important discovery, and I don't want to give anything away, but I just want to talk around this scene. She makes a discovery, and she later thinks about what she could have said to this person who already knows what she thinks she's discovered. She imagines a scenario, and in the end, she decides, so maybe I would have spit out all those things that I had figured out while slapping the gnats away, and when I was done, my voice choked, my face all balled up in a battle against the tears. He would have leaned toward me and said again, I always knew you were the smart one. So I think without actually saying what she discovered, I think we can talk a little bit about, in writing a scene like this, do you ever go ahead and write the scene as if she had done the thing she thinks she wished she had done, or did you just write it that way? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it would never have occurred to me to write it another way. I mean, that's far enough in the book that I know Mimi down to the ground.
Okay.
And what that means is, at that point in the novel, if I don't know exactly how Mimi would act in almost every situation, I'm kind of sunk. But luckily, and it's particularly important in a first-person novel where you really have to be doing some version of literary ventriloquism, luckily, I felt like I really was comfortable inside Mimi from pretty much the very beginning, and I knew exactly how she would act in that situation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And even right down to her considering what she could have said is part of her character, isn't it? Like thinking about it because she's a thoughtful, intelligent person, but not actually doing it.
Right.
At that point anyway.
Yeah.
Let's see. I just wanted to ask you do you know what your next project is going to be?
I'm fairly into the beginning of a new novel.
Okay. And that's
okay. So,
all right. And
but I hate to talk about them early days because they feel all mushy and like shaky to me at this point.
Are you able to make time for writing when you're doing a book tour, or do you take a
no? Absolutely not. It's not. Yeah. It's not even making the time for writing. It's making the time for thinking. You know, yeah. I have to have for me to be successful as a writer. I have to have a very boring, humdrum routine as a person. And when I'm actually working on a book, it's the same routine every day. Mm-hmm. I just saw this great quote from Edna O'Brien. I can't remember what it was exactly, but it was about the challenge of being sociable when you're a writer because it feels as though the real world is back at your desk. Mm-hmm. And that really is the kind of life that you create for yourself, an unvarying life with no drama and no guessing, you know, everything's sort of set to music that enables you to step out of the real world and into the realer one of the novel.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and I think, too, just the fact that sometimes people are more comfortable in their office working with their characters, you know, and then you have to go out and talk about it to real people, and that gets harder. I don't know. You don't seem like that kind of person. You seem like you're pretty comfortable in either situation. But
no, but there's a great quote from Eudora Welty where she says, to go outside and bang the drum is only to, to something and to lose, and then she says, fiction has and must keep a private address. And I think that's so true and so profound. You can't do this on the fly. You want the reader to live in the world of the novel, and to do that, you have to live in the world of the novel in an unvarying way.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to just ask whether you've read anything, maybe not recently because you're on this book tour, but if you've read anything in the last year or so that you particularly enjoyed that you might recommend people take a look at?
All Things Cease to Appear by Elizabeth Brundage.
Okay.
I finished it about 2 weeks ago, went to her website and sent her a mash note because I feel like, you know, if you read something that you really admire, you have to reach out to the writer and say, you're not sitting there for nothing.
Oh, wow.
So,
that's great.
Yeah, and actually she and I have since then developed a kind of a nice email back and forth about this. I, however, think that she should probably be much more grateful to the tweet from Stephen King talking about what a great book it is.
Wow.
Since he seems to have more than a million Twitter followers. But I've talked about it a number of times on tour because I think it's a very, very fine novel, so beautifully written that I kept stopping to reread sentences in awe and wonder.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, and while I've got you talking about books, I was curious to know if The Group by Mary McCarthy is one of your favorites.
I wouldn't quite describe it like that. What I would say is that it's a really pivotal book in my development.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I learned about sex from it. I still have my paperback copy. I'm looking at it right now with the daisies on the front. But the fact that it was a vivid portrait of really, really smart, college-educated women who then wound up unhappy and at a loose end because they turned themselves into wives and mothers had a lot to do with the development of my nascent feminism.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to wind up being one of those women.
It felt important to me. Something about the way that you wrote about it in this book felt like...
Right.
Yeah. All right, great. So this is my last question for you, Anna. I'm wondering if you have any advice for writers for finding and developing characters, and also about writing about family beyond writing about our own families.
I was doing an event last week in Connecticut with Amy Bloom, who is a novelist mm-hmm. that I very much admire.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked her how being a psychotherapist had informed her work as a novelist. And she said, only to the extent that it taught me to listen. And I think that it's so important to pay attention to all of the permutations of the world around you. That's what takes you outside of writing about yourself or your own family. Eavesdropping at Target, staring across the aisle on the subway train, listening to the other moms waiting to do school pickup, listening to the radio. I just think... the more you can listen as a writer, the more you will learn about human beings, and the more you know about human beings, the easier it is to build character.
Okay, that's wonderful advice. The book is Miller's Valley, published by Random House by Anna Quinlan. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks, it was really interesting.
Okay, great, thanks.
I learned a lot about my own work. That
oh,
was
good.
Great.
That, again, was a conversation with Anna Quinlan. You can learn more about her work at her website, annaquinlan.net. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Anna Quinlan, who finds a certain approach to her work invaluable. At the end of any given writing day, she never stops her work at the end of a chapter or a paragraph or a sentence. She stops right in the middle. She finds getting started in the morning is really challenging because, as she says, of course, writing is so terrifying and difficult. But if she looks at the screen and there is a half-written sentence, she can almost always manage to finish the rest of that sentence, which will frequently lead her into the next one. If she had to start a new chapter from scratch first thing, she says, she could be paralyzed for days. Stopping in mid-sentence has been a boon as far as getting started in the morning, which is her most vulnerable time. So good luck trying this approach, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. One other thing that I'll share along the lines of advice from this interview, I looked up the Eudora Welty quote that Anna mentioned, and I found it, so I thought I would just read it to you in full. Writing fiction is an interior affair. Novels and stories always will be put down little by little out of personal feeling and personal beliefs arrived at alone and at first hand over a period of time as time is needed. To go outside and beat the drum is only to interrupt, and so finally to forget and to lose. Fiction has and must keep a private address, for life is lived in a private place where it means anything is inside the mind and heart. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. And by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space for meetings, events, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information or come on down to the Burlington waterfront. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary's website is GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at bigheavyworld.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.